So we are continuing a series we began last week entitled Asking for a Friend. And during this series, we are looking to address some of the challenging and frequently asked questions that come up. And today we're going to talk about this one: is Christianity intolerant? Let me tell you some of the other ideas we're going to look at, some of the other questions. Why does God allow evil, right? If God is good, why is there evil? Why doesn't God answer my prayer? And I just meet a lot of people who wonder about that. Here's one question that didn't make the cut, and I just want to get a little bit of a sense of, you know, how you guys are just interested in this or not. But one of the questions was, does the Bible allow for aliens and the existence of that? Anybody interested in? No, it must have been all the people online who were asking about that. Maybe next time we'll look at that. But today we're going to look at, is Christianity intolerant? And this is the idea that often is expressed this way, that, hey, you know, doesn't all religion teach basically the same thing? And if one person believes that what they believe is right, it's going to make them arrogant. It's going to make them judgmental. It might even make them hostile to people who believe differently. There was a poet by the name of William Blake, and in the late 1700s, he wrote a book, and this is the cover of it, and this is what they looked like a long time ago. He, as far as I know, is the first person to express this idea. The title of this book was All Religions Are One, that they basically teach the same idea, are all leading in the same direction, and that idea is quite common in our day. What's interesting about that idea and about sort of proposing that sort of proposition is that we don't believe that in any other arena. In any other arena, we recognize that, hey, something, you know, is in the same field, but those ideas are not the same. For example, in the political arena, democracy is not the same as fascism. Right, they're both political, but they are not the same, and I think we know which one is better. In the economic realm, capitalism is not the same as communism, right? They're economic systems, but they are not the same, and I think we know that one is better than the other. In the arena of football, we know that the Cowboys are not the Broncos, and we know which one is better. Thank you all for agreeing with me. And you know, if you read these columns down, it just begins to make a lot of sense there of where they sit. But back to the whole realm of spirituality, because often what we hear said is, how can anyone know that what they believe is right when we're dealing with things that are so difficult and maybe nebulous in understanding? And then maybe you've heard, you know, this sort of idea too, and you can fill in the blank. Maybe you've heard it in different ways. If I was born somewhere, I'd be a whatever the predominant faith is in that arena. So if I was born in Bombay, India, I'd be a Hindu. If I was born in Morocco, I would be a Muslim. And there was actually a student who proposed that idea to his theology professor, saying, you know, I was born here in a Christian nation, therefore, you know, that's why I'm sort of under that banner. But if I'd born in Morocco, I would have been a Muslim. So I think the best response to that is to just be an agnostic, and to say, you know, how can we know anything for sure? And the professor responded, but yeah, if you were born in Morocco, you would be a Muslim and not an agnostic. And so that argument doesn't really hold water. But I think there's even a more fundamental question that goes along with it. Do we even want a particular faith to be true? And I wonder if sometimes we want to say, hey, it's all basically the same, because what that may do, well do, is let us off the hook when it comes to accountability. Because then I can pick and choose and be a little bit more selective in what it is that I believe. Do we really want a belief to be true? I can remember sitting with a Utah State University engineering student a few years ago. And he was talking about, you know, well, can I really believe in the flood and were the animals on a big boat and all of that and some other, you know, specific issues around what the Bible talks about. And then there was this moment of just incredible honesty and clarity. And he looked at me, he said, you know what I think the bottom line is? I just don't want anyone telling me what to do. And boy, did I appreciate that honesty, because I wonder if sometimes that's the issue. And then we look for particulars, you know, to say, well, you know, can we really believe anything? But what is beneath that is a desire to maybe not be ultimately accountable. And so in a world where there are different beliefs, this is really what we're going to look at today. What is our posture toward people of other faiths? What does that look like? What does that sound like? What does that act like? And to do that, what we're going to do is we're going to trace the story in the Old Testament. We're going to look at something that happened between the Old Testament and the New Testament. There's about a 400-year gap in there. And then we're going to look at the journey of somebody in the New Testament and really land on this idea of what it looks like, what it should look like in terms of engaging the world around us and people who believe different things. So in the Old Testament, there's a book called Numbers, and in Numbers chapters 22 and 23, there's an interesting story when the nation of Israel is about to move into the promised land. God frees those Hebrew people from 400 plus years of slavery in a nation called Egypt. He has miraculously led them, and he's taking them to a land that he has promised to them. And they're on the verge of doing that. They've conquered some other nations. There is only one nation that is left to conquer, and its name is Moab. And the king of Moab, his name is Balak, he sees this whole nation there poised to come into this land, and he doesn't want that to happen. And so what does he do? Well, he comes up with plan A. Plan A is to hire a guy named Balaam. He's like a soothsayer, sort of a spiritualist. And one of the things we say here, just because it's spiritual doesn't mean it's holy. And he hires Balaam to curse Israel. And so Balaam is on his way to do that. He's riding his donkey, and then all of a sudden the donkey turns aside from the road because the donkey is able to see that there's an angel standing in the road, but Balaam can't see it. And so Balaam begins to put the whip to the donkey to try to get him back on the track, and then God gives the donkey the ability to speak. It is a story that gives me hope every Saturday night, because if God spoke through a donkey once, he can do it again on a Sunday morning. But they begin to have this dialogue, and it's a little bit of a debate there. And he says, you know, why are you beating me? You know, have I ever misled you before and been, you know, a bad donkey before? And Balaam, you know, still doesn't see what the whole issue is. And then ultimately the donkey wins the debate, which is a very interesting story. And they decide that they are not going to continue to do what they have been hired to do, and God leads them in a different direction. So the king of Moab, Balak, decides, well, I'm not giving up on this whole mission to turn these people aside. So he comes up with plan B. What is plan B? Something called idolatry. It sounds like an old Bible word, but I got to tell you, it's as relevant and real as our day today. Because what idolatry is at its heart and soul is trusting anyone and anything more than we trust God. And it often involves utilizing spiritual forces, not for the sake of serving the poor and being faithful to one another and honoring God. It is about me, myself, and I, because the idol promises that I'm going to get some giant payoff, but it never delivers. In fact, what it winds up doing is producing enslavement. And I think we've experienced that, you know, in this generation, just like every other generation before has. But here's how it played out in that day. They actually get some Moabite women to come and be in promiscuous relationships with the Israelites. And so this was a step away from faithfulness to spouse, as God had given that direction and that boundary. And it was certainly not, you know, being faithful to God either. And this just becomes commonplace in the camp of Israel. And many times, you know, the greatest threats are not necessarily out there. It's what happens in here that can, you know, just torpedo the direction God has for us. And the lowest point of all of that is when one of those Israelites brings one of those Moabite women into the camp, and in full sight of Moses and all the others, is getting involved in a relationship, a physical one, with her. And what's a person to do? Well, in that story, there's a man by the name of Phinehas, and Phinehas grabs a spear and catches them in the act and runs them through together with that spear. And Phineas is commended for the step that he took, and there is a word that is associated with him in the evaluation of what he did, and it was the word zeal, that he had great zeal. And another word for zeal would be the word passion. Passion for God to take a stand against those who would dishonor God. We might even say the enemies of God. And Phineas is often viewed as a hero, as somebody who took a stand and honored the God that he trusted. You fast forward a number of years, and between the New Testament and the Old Testament, there's that 400-year period. And as a matter of historical record, there was a Syrian king by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes who came down and conquered the area of Israel. And he was totally disrespectful to the beliefs of anyone else. And so what he did in Israel is he took a pig, which was symbolically the most unclean animal of them all. And you know what he did? He went into the temple in Jerusalem, and in the most holy place, he sacrificed that pig, which was an absolute abomination to the people. Well, what's a person to do? Many people were incensed by that. But there was one guy, his name was Judas Maccabeus. And he gathered together a group of what we might term freedom fighters and took them against the might of the Syrian army and against great odds that are leveraged against them. He defeated the Syrians, drove them out, and won a measure of freedom for a couple hundred years. His nickname became Judas the Hammer. And the record of his accomplishments would have been recorded. And so the story of Phineas and the story of Judas the Hammer would have been around for somebody that we encounter in the New Testament who would have been familiar with both of those and would have likely viewed them as heroes of the faith. But now as we get to the New Testament, what is the occupying nation? It's Rome. And that same idea is there. What are we to do? How do we take a stand against all the things that are happening? And in the New Testament, there is a word that's associated with Paul. We're going to see it in a few moments. Zealous. He had great zeal. He had great passion for God. There was even a group of freedom fighters against Rome. And you know what their name was? Zealots. And it comes from that word zeal. People with so much passion that they want to do and are willing to do whatever it takes to stand against the enemies of God. And Paul is one of those guys. And he hears about some people who are following a radical rabbi named Jesus. And you know what he's going to do about it? He's going to take some action. And maybe informed by many of the heroes and the stories that came before him, what he does is pretty serious. Acts chapter 7 is the first time that we meet him, and he is around when a guy named Stephen is being stoned to death. And we're talking old school stoning here, okay, not 1970s stoning. They're going to throw rocks at somebody until he dies. And falling to his knees, he is Stephen, cried out with a loud voice, Lord, do not hold this sin against them. And when he had said this, he fell asleep. That is their way of saying, like we would say, he passed away. He died. And who approved of his execution? Saul, whose name was later changed to Paul. He's got zeal. He's got passion. And he's probably remembering some of the stories of the heroes of old and thinking, you know what? We need to be just as serious in our day, and we need to take that kind of stand. Here's how he refers to himself a little bit later on. Circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, as to the law, a Pharisee, as to, and there it is, zeal, passion, a persecutor of the church, as to righteousness under the law, blameless. I was all in and completely committed and believed that zeal needed to express itself in even dramatic ways in opposition to those who stand against the God that I've come to know and to trust. Here's something else he says in the book of Galatians. For you have heard of my former life in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God violently and tried to destroy it. And I was advancing in Judaism beyond many my own age among my people. So, look at this adverb. Extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers. So if you're going to have like a school of people who are zealous, Paul was first in his class. And he says, I was completely committed. I was all in. And then something happened. On the other side of being there when somebody is put to death with rocks because they believe something different, Saul is on a trip to go to a city called Damascus, and he's going to do more of the same. Round up people who are following this rabbi named Jesus. And maybe some will wind up in prison, maybe some are going to wind up dead, but that is what he sees as his mission from God in this world. And then something happens. Acts chapter 9. But Paul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked him for letters of the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, that's the way that they referred to people who were following Jesus at the very beginning, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. What is he going to do? Now, as he went on his way, he approached Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. And what he discovers in the verses that follow this is that God is revealing himself to him. And I wonder, as he gets that vision, and it is Jesus, I wonder, this is not contained in the Bible, but I wonder if he's thinking, this is the moment in which God is going to commend me as a hero of the faith to say, you know what, Saul, you are all in and what you are doing is all right and you have my blessing and you are being commended. Is his zeal being rewarded? But that's not what happens that day. And he is not commended for what he's doing. And falling to the ground, he heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And he said, and this is one of the great questions of all time, a question that no matter who we are, where we come from, or what we believe right now, I think this is a question that is a good one to ask ourselves. Who are you, Lord? Who are you? And he said, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. That what you have been doing as you hurt one of those people is you have been hurting, persecuting me. And the one who heard the stories about someone picking up a spear on behalf of God and someone driving out enemies on behalf of God instead sees one who took a spear in his side rather than taking up his spear to defeat his enemies. And he discovers that what God has done in this world is he's turned some things upside down. Because in this moment, Saul does not stop believing in the prophets of the Old Testament. He does not stop believing in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Rachel, and Rebecca, and Sarah, and so many others. But his understanding of what it means to be passionate for God, especially with those who believe something different, has just been turned over. Because the one who was speaking to him was unjustly nailed to a cross, and he could have taken his enemies out if he wanted to, but instead he died for them. And do you know who that includes? That includes you and me. Well, how do you know that? In the book of Romans, it says this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. We were enemies of God. And what did Jesus do? He died for us. He served us. He opened the door to a relationship with him. And that realization and that moment of just transcendent clarity is going to change so much for Saul. And what he thought was passion, he doesn't leave his passion behind, but all of a sudden it's going to become something very different because he has now had this personal encounter with the God who has laid down his life for him. So Jesus gives Saul some instructions. I want you to go to Damascus and you're going to go to this particular place, and he's blinded by this light, and so now he is led as somebody who is blind. And at the same time, a man in Damascus whose name is Ananias is told, hey, you're going to go and meet with this guy named Saul. And Ananias has heard about Saul. What he's doing has become common knowledge because no doubt people were sharing it on Twitter and Facebook and all of that, and everybody was up to speed on who Saul is, and it wasn't going well if you were a follower of Jesus. And so Ananias says in response to that, a little bit of a paraphrase, God, you have commanded many great things, but this ain't one of them. For me to go and meet with the guy who has been killing followers of yours, just not a good idea. But the Lord said to him now is Ananias, go, for he, Paul, is a chosen instrument of mine to carry my name before the Gentiles and kings and children of Israel, for I will show him how much he must suffer for the sake of my name. And so when Ananias goes and meets with Saul, later Paul, does he say, hey, you know what? I know what you're about, and God's given me a little glimpse of what's in your future. Boy, are you in for it. You really should have done something different than what you did, and now you're going to get yours. But he doesn't. And so somebody maybe who has had to flee the city of Jerusalem because of what Saul has been doing, who no doubt knew somebody who had been put to death by the guy named Saul, goes and meets with him. And by the way, a quick aside, sometimes, you know, people say, hey, I got this really hard thing, but I don't feel any peace about it. And so if I don't feel any peace, then maybe I shouldn't go ahead and do it. I think this story tells us peace is not always the indicator of what God's direction is for us. And sometimes peace is on the other side of obedience, not before obedience. And so it's not often the path of least resistance. And so Ananias does the hard thing, and he gets up and he goes. Ananias departed and entered the house, and laying his hands on him, he said, Brother Saul. He uses a relational term because somebody who is in a relationship with the Jesus of the Bible now meets somebody else who has just stepped into that relationship with that same Jesus of the Bible. And what does that mean? It means that there's a connection. And of course, this is language meant to communicate relationship. And if you know anything about the New Testament letters that Paul wrote, he was fanatical about using family terms to refer to people that he was writing to. And maybe that's because he received that right off the bat from somebody who would have had every right to view him very differently, very negatively, and been pretty strong with their judgment of him. Family language. You know, I think we understand that in this world. You know, sometimes I've traveled on different trips to different parts of the world, and I've been called uncle in some cultures. I've been called brother by some people. In Japan, I was called sensei. That's just cool, right? It's like I know karate or something like that. And, you know, I come from, you know, a group of people that tends not to use those relational words. There are, you know, many families and cultures that use family language, but I come from the Germanic people. We don't even refer to our blood uncles as uncle because on the other side of that, there might be the implication that somebody needs to hug somebody, and that's just, you know, way too much in our personal space. But in this, there is a clear sense that something has dramatically shifted because of stepping into a relationship with the Jesus of the Bible. And I think we can understand from Paul that, you know what he dedicated himself to? Understanding what it is that Jesus did and how he made this real. What did Jesus do to engage this world of ours and cultures, maybe that we're in different places of belief? There's one story that comes to us recorded in the book of Luke. And Jesus and his disciples are walking through a Samaritan village, and it's hard for us to have the emotional reaction of what it means to be a Jewish person in a Samaritan village. Maybe for us, it'd be like walking through an area that is completely occupied and run by ISIS. And so on the other side of that, and the emotion that we might feel, I wonder if we could identify with what the disciples say on that day. James and John saw it, and they said, Lord, do you want us to tell fire to come down from heaven and consume them? God, should we nuke them in God's name? Would that be good? We've got passion. Yes, we do. We've got passion. How about you? We've got zeal. I mean, isn't that what the heroes of old would have done? These are people who believe something different. They are at odds with the God that we know. Are they going to be commended? But he, Jesus, turned and rebuked them. You don't know the heart of God. And yeah, they believe something different. But God loves them. And I came so that anyone and everyone could step into a relationship with God. Doesn't mean that everything is the same. But it does mean that passion and zeal for God, that's a good thing. But how it manifests itself is often very different than the way that it does in this world. And it's as if Paul began to get his arms around this. How did Jesus do it? What did he do? What did he say? How did he engage culture? In the book of Romans, Paul writes these words, "For I bear them witness," and he's talking about people who are still in that, we're going to take a stand against the enemies of God. "For I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God," passion, "but not according to knowledge." The problem is in passion. The problem is in the way in which it is utilized, expressed, said, the actions done on the other side of that. And could it be that passion for God that is not informed with knowledge or by the example of Jesus results in things like crusades and maybe in more recent times in terrorism? Passion for God is a good thing. It needs to be informed by knowledge. And this is what he says just a couple chapters later, is, "Do not be slothful in zeal." Isn't that a great verse right there? So it's not, hey, don't have any zeal, don't have any passion. He's saying pursue it, but be fervent in spirit, serve the Lord. And just a couple verses later, "Bless those who persecute you, bless them and do not curse them." Where did he get that? That is almost a direct quote from the words that Jesus said in something we call the Sermon on the Mount. That's where he got it. And so when it comes to people who may believe different things, passion for God is a great thing. How does it express itself? And Jesus sets us an example that, you know what? Rather than rising in conflict or in judgment, in condemnation, see somebody who is loved by God, who believes something different. Serve them. Care about them. Love them. And share the hope that you have in Jesus. Because not all beliefs are the same. Well, how do you know that? What makes you informed by that? I don't, but this is what Jesus said one day. "I am the way, the truth, and the life. And no one comes to the Father except through me." And so the one who knows everything about everything didn't say all beliefs lead in one direction. And he didn't put a label across, you know, a church like this or any other. What he did say is, he is the way. The way to belong to God is a person. It's Jesus, the Jesus of the Bible. And the example that he set for engaging and interacting with the world around us that believes all kinds of different things is to not shrink back from what is truth, but it is to love, to serve, and to care. And so I might challenge you and me to do something this coming week. Is there one person that you can think of that believes something different than you do? Pray for them. Serve them. Love them. And if the opportunity presents, share the hope that you have in the one who made a radical statement that if this is true, there is one way, and it's Jesus. And he came to invite everyone to himself. Just yesterday, I made a phone call to somebody, and I heard that his health was not good. And it's somebody that we met several years ago. We do serve projects here. We had one this last summer. And several years ago, we had a serve project in West Bountiful. And one of the homes that received that group of people who came to work on that home was the home of this gentleman. And at that time, he really wasn't believing anything, not specifically. But over the course of time, he actually took that step to become a follower of Jesus. And it just entirely transformed him. How did that happen? By serving, no strings attached, by sharing the hope that is found in the Jesus of the Bible. As I found out yesterday, he's got maybe 48 hours left in this world, maybe tops. And it changes everything to know that there is one who is the way to belong to God, the truth he claims to understand reality the way it really is, and the life. That there's a relationship that begins when we trust him and it never ends. It goes beyond life in this world. And so in all of that, what are we saying and what is our posture? Jesus is the way, and so is his example. So as we live in a day like this and we engage a world like ours, may we understand what Jesus has invited us to do, to serve, to love, to care, and to share the hope that is found in him and in him alone. Would you bow your heads together with me as I pray? And just before I do, I wonder, could it be that it is time to take a step into that relationship? This church can't save you. No church can save any of us. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And if you've never taken that step, it begins by just admitting the truth about ourselves, acknowledging that we fall so far short, and asking him to forgive us for the many ways that we have defied him, dishonored him, done our own thing. And it's asking him to make us a part of his family. And it's a commitment to follow him the rest of our days. And Lord Jesus, thank you for the opportunity that there is to know that there's a God who loves us and everyone we know. We have never locked eyes with someone who does not matter to you. And so may our hope be in you, and God, may you also be our example of what it means to be a light in this world. Not to curse the darkness, but to proclaim the light that is found in Jesus. Lead us in that direction, God, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.